Welcome once again to our program, Interpreting the Scriptures Through the Ages. Ron Eldred, a teacher at John Paul II Catholic High of Religion and Biblical Studies, is again our wonderful guest. I'm the host, Monsignor Larry Moran, Pastor Emeritus here at St. Patrick Catholic Church at 19th and Poplar. Ron, we've been talking about the different approaches, the supernaturalistic, the natural approach, and then Richard Strauss, who came up with the mythological approach to interpreting the scriptures, all of which, mythological and naturalistic, have caused havoc in modern times. Can you tell us what Strauss means by calling the Gospels mythological?
Well, we've been quoting Marcus Borg, who is one of the members of the so-called Jesus Seminar that we'll take a look at in some later sessions. But Strauss maintained that the text of the Gospels has a different explanation than those of either the rationalist or the supernaturalist. We talked about both of those last time. Strauss uses the imagery of the early church's inherited religious and literary tradition. That is, the Hebrew Bible as a whole, or the Bible as a whole. In this particular case, the story of Exodus, for example, found in 16:13-36 of God's feeding the people of Israel in the wilderness with manna, to make a statement about the spiritual significance of Jesus. In other words, Strauss is going to connect Old Testament prophets and Old Testament stories with Jesus. This is Strauss's technique. That is, the point of the text is not to report what Jesus did on a particular day, but to make the claim that Jesus is the bread of life who feeds his followers with spiritual feed even to this day, just as God had fed the Israelites in the desert with manna in the desert. Strauss is trying to make this connection, you see, between Jesus and Old Testament prophets, such as Moses in this particular case. And in other words, the gospel writers created a myth about Jesus based on various stories in the Old Testament. That's where they got their ideas, you see, according to Strauss. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, who are writing supposedly the second or third generation after Jesus, in other words, not really being eyewitnesses, that they're using Old Testament stories to formulate myths about Jesus. Using this mythological approach allowed Strauss to avoid the supernaturalist explanation that Jesus really performed the miracles related in the New Testament, and the rationalist explanation that explains away his miracles by natural occurrences. So Philip Trower, he sheds further light on this subject, where he writes that myth for Strauss means, quote, the clothing and historic form of religious ideas shaped by the unconsciously invented power of legend and embodied in an historical personality, quote. He says that Jesus of Nazareth was an historical person who in the course of his life and under the influence of the spirit of the age, especially the strong strain of messianic expectation that characterized the Jewish religious thought of the time, came to believe that he was the Messiah whom the Jews expected. The admiration and reverence he evoked in his followers was so strong that after his death, they proceeded unconsciously to invest him with legendary and mythological attributes. Their myth-making tendencies were encouraged by the strong messianic expectations of the contemporary Jews of the time. All the messianic allusions of the Old Testament, its references to traits that the future Messiah would have, could quite naturally be absorbed into their increasingly idealized picture of Jesus. In other words, kind of interjecting here this quotation, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, not eyewitnesses, people writing supposedly in the late first century, the early second century, they know all these Old Testament stories about these prophets and what these prophets did and what was prophesied and this, that, and the other. And so they're using that as a basis to develop all these myths about Jesus, applying him to Jesus. A generation or two after Jesus is already dead, you see, the later church. Getting back to the quote, the final stage of their mythologizing was the attribution to him of divine qualities. He became for them the Son of God. The Jesus of Scripture is then a combination of historical fact and Christian imagination. fashioning an historical figure into a divine person through the process of mythologizing this figure. End of quote. In other words, the evangelists were not lying when they claimed that Jesus had performed all these miracles, that is, the Jesus of history, but they had come to believe it themselves. In other words, they were deluded. So they were just sort of were manufacturing these myths, but they were getting the ideas from the Old Testament about the prophets and the prophecies were made about the Messiah and things like that.
Now, that's a very subtle appealing to explanation that, well, it, to explain how these myths developed.
This is all based on the idea that the Bible wasn't written in, let's say, before the year 70, when the Romans conquered Jerusalem and after a rebellion in 67 and destroyed the city, much of the city and the temple. Most scripture scholars today would say that the Matthew, Mark, and Luke were written probably, certainly by the 60s of the first century. So obviously it was written by men who actually could have been there and witnessed Jesus' suffering and death and his resurrection. On the other hand, Strauss is arguing that it was written after that period. Now, we know John wasn't written until maybe 90s.
Okay.
We know that. He was a young man, of course, when Jesus suffered and died and rose again from the dead. And so, you know, he would have been a man in his 80s or 90s when he actually wrote his gospel. But Strauss is claiming that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John was not written by these men, men who had actually witnessed these events, at least Matthew and John had. He's arguing that this is written by a later generation of Christians just simply using those names to give it credibility. And maybe they were written as late as, let's say, the mid-second century. So that being the case, they could not have been written by eyewitnesses, and this allows enough time for myths to develop. And where they're getting their myths from is from the Old Testament, ideas they get from the Old Testament prophets, and they sort of, clothe Jesus with those.
Well, and Jesus was the new Moses.
Sure.
In a very special way, but even more so. Well, okay, say once again, because we talked about it a little bit ago, then we'll go on to some examples of how this process of myth building works. But why, say again, why would Strauss and Marcus Borg, these people who apparently lost their Christian faith, want to debunk the miracles as real historical facts in the gospel? What are they trying to do?
Well, I suppose it would depend on the individual, but for the most of them, I think you could almost take the example of Spinoza. They don't believe the Bible literally as it is, but they believe that there's some good in it. And so if you can debunk the Bible, if you can run it down the supernatural aspects of it, you can maintain and you can come up with a natural explanation of Jesus, a Jesus who they perceived was a good man, a holy man, some kind of a leader, a reformer, or a revolutionary. They have all kinds of, you know, books have been written from these different points of view. If you can destroy the supernatural idea of Jesus, that in its place you can develop kind of a humanistic, kind of a naturalistic kind of religion in its place. That's what Spinoza had an interest in doing. And that's what I think Marcus Borg has an interest in doing.
So to kind of build a new utopia on secular human values.
Yes, a secular humanism, actually.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay, well, I just didn't want to get you
off the track. It's a this-worldly kind of heaven. It's a world where there's people practice,
love one another.
What Jesus taught about loving one another and that kind of thing. That's what Spinoza wanted to do. He thought that aspect of Jesus was fine.
Sure.
He just didn't like all that supernatural stuff.
And that Jesus was God made
man
and all the time.
And he performed
things.
Miracles and
okay.
Like
well, let me get you back on the track here. Can you give us an example of how the process of myth building worked according to Strauss?
Well, for one, how did Jesus come to believe that he was the Messiah? And Trout tells us that Strauss believed that Jesus had come to believe that he was the Messiah sometime before his death. He says this was probably a gradually dawning consciousness. And Strauss didn't believe that this belief made Jesus a fanatic because, quote Strauss, he too was, like most of his contemporaries, subject to the suggestive power that myth-making exercised on the men of his time, end of quote. And then once convinced, in other words, Jesus knew what was in the Old Testament too about prophets and things like that. And so once that convinced that he was the Messiah, Trauer states of Strauss's view that, quote, it is easy to conceive how that conviction could have led Jesus to see his own suffering and death as an inevitable consequence of his acceptance of that role, end of quote. And Strauss points out how the Old Testament had said a lot about a suffering servant, for example, you know, taken in Isaiah 53, especially 52 and 53. Messiah, especially in Isaiah, as I said. It is understandable that Jesus' followers would conclude that, quote, death willingly accepted would possess an atoning power and would exert a powerful spiritual influence on the lives of his followers, end of quote. And from this reasoning, Strauss concluded that, Trauer here, the death of Jesus was indeed an historical fact, but the implication that Christians have found in that death were in large part put there by Jesus himself, a human person who was formed in his thought patterns by the religious climate of his times. That is, by the religious climate of the times, the Messiah, the idea of the Messiah, the prophecies about the Messiah. And Jesus had come to believe that he actually was the Messiah because he was, influenced by these views.
Okay.
Well, Trauer identifies another important factor in the shaping of the final form of the New Testament that was envisioned by Strauss, and this was the impact of Jesus' powerful personality on his apostles and disciples. Trauer states that, quote, much of the detail about Jesus, his healing power, his resurrection, his divinity, is due to their reaction to the strength and attractiveness of his personality. Intimations of his messianic consciousness, for example, would be given to his followers, and once the seed was planted, their reverence for him would soon naturally lead them to link his deeds and words with the Old Testament descriptions of the future Messiah, end of quote. And this explains how the stories of his healings, his prophecies, and his miraculous raising from the dead made their way into the story of his life. Well, Strauss argued that Jesus' followers were convinced that he equaled or surpassed the deeds performed by the prophets of the Old Testament. Obviously, if he is the Messiah, he has to, surpass the prophets of the Old Testament.
Okay.
For example, the prophet Eliseus had cured Naaman, the Syrian, of leprosy and raised the son of a Sunamite woman from the dead, which led to the stories that Jesus cured the sick and raised people from the dead. This is all Strauss's way of reasoning. Strauss also thought that the transfiguration of Moses' face after his conversion, his conversation with God on Mount Sinai, provided the background material for the story of of Jesus' transfiguration. In this regard, Trauer states, quote, such thinking introduced the miraculous cures into the New Testament and led finally to the conclusion that since he was greater than the prophets of the old law, not only did he raise others to life, but his own superior power affected his own resurrection, end of quote. This is how Strauss turned the stories of Jesus' miracles into myths, in other words. The evangelist just made them up to prove that Jesus fulfilled the prophecies about the Messiah told in the Old Testament. But even Jesus had kind of come to believe that himself, according to the way Strauss... And that's the kind of stuff I was reading, when I read Strauss's book.
It's very appealing. It makes sense in terms of obviously Strauss and Borg knew the Old Testament well.
Well, it's appealing, but it's very disturbing too.
Absolutely.
Because it does disturb. I know from my own experience I can tell you right now that if a person went down to, let's say, the Christian bookstore, or even most Catholic bookstores, And certainly at the Books a Million or, you know, Barnes & Noble or any of those places, they'll usually have a rather large section of books on religion. Okay. And a lot of times they'll also have right next to that or in the same area books of New Age type books. There'll be a lot of titles in there about Jesus. And I can tell you right now that probably 95% of those books are dangerous to people's faith if they have faith already. Because they're
Protestant books, or Catholic.
Yes, Protestant or Catholic. Yeah. Because basically those books reflect this kind of the mythological or the naturalistic way of explaining Jesus' life. And it's pretty much the dominant. The large number of programs, and I suppose we're starting to get them now. Of course, Easter is beginning to approach, that you see on the History Channel and these other channels are of this type. They explain Jesus' miracles as, or his life. It's really the Christ of faith that we know about, and we don't really know the real Jesus, the real Jesus of history, who was just a man, you know, who did good deeds and had a good intention and all that kind of thing, but he didn't do all these miracles and he didn't make all these supernatural claims and things like that. And as I said, a lot of these programs on TV and on half a dozen different channels or more, and many, many of the books that you can buy on the bookstands are of that type, trying to taking this particular position.
So this is why, one of the reasons that Pope Benedict XVI came out with the idea of the writing his book and saying the Jesus of history and the Christ of faith are the same person. They're not two different persons. And boy, that's so...
In other words, what we read in the Bible, what we read in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is, and Acts, is Jesus, or in St. Paul. That's the real Jesus. It may not necessarily be in the exact order that Jesus did things. That's not important. Because Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John didn't write their books as histories. They didn't write their books as biographies. They wrote the books to tell what Jesus taught and what he wants us to do and how to, things of that sort. Their purpose wasn't to write biographies or narrative histories like we think in terms of history or biography today.
Okay. Good distinction, an important distinction. Well, Ron, may I ask you, how about the rest of the New Testament? Did Strauss follow through with the same type of mythologizing on not just the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but on the rest of the New Testament?
Oh, yes, he did. Borg, who was a real, admirer of Strauss, he says that Strauss followed the same procedure with the text after text. To quote Borg, this article that he wrote about Strauss, quote, "The virgin birth, Jesus' vision at his baptism," these are still things, of course, in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, "the story of the transfiguration, the healing miracles, all are understood as the product of the early church's use of Jewish ideas about what the Messiah would be like in order to express the conviction that Jesus was indeed the Messiah," end of quote. And it is Strauss's treatment of the life of Jesus that was so disconcerting, as I said, when I first read his book, in 1957, as a young man. He did come out with a popular version, as I mentioned before, and that's probably the one that I actually read. And I like to mention two other characteristics of Strauss's work that is worth noting. First, he favored the synoptics as more historical than John.
Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptics.
Yeah, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are the synoptics. And they thought it was a lot, he thought it was a lot more historical than John. In fact, that's very common amongst a lot of scripture scholars today. They think John's probably not hardly historical at all. The little bit of history, the little bit of the true Jesus that we are going to find is going to be in somehow couched or hidden, amongst all of that myth kind of stuff that found its way in the Christians, according to these scholars.
Because John is written in such an entirely language and mode.
And then it was written, they know it was written, we know it was written much later. John, he's the eagle, he's the one who soars. He starts out, in the beginning was the Word. That's kind of an application of Greek philosophy, to the understanding of the Trinity. And but actually, when you read John, There are a lot of scripture scholars today that are beginning to come to the view that John really is very historical. And when I read John, I find John, a lot more chronologically accurate and things like that than you do when you read Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
Okay.
And a second thing that I like to mention is that like a man by the name of Weiss and Schweitzer, some 60 years later, and we'll talk about Schweitzer, we're going to spend a whole half-hour session on him, he attributed a strong eschatological expectation to Jesus, and by eschatological we mean, of course, the end times. Oh, that's a big thing with a lot of these Jesus seminar people, this idea of the eschatological Jesus. But we'll get back to that later.
Okay. Well, why did Strauss play down St. John's gospel in his interpretation of the life of Jesus?
Well, you sort of alluded to that a while ago when you made your comment about, how philosophical or how his sores, and all that kind of thing, his gospel. And it was St. John's gospel that provided Strauss with the last link in his chain of mythological interpretation of the scripture. And according to Strauss, it is in St. John's gospel that Jesus is portrayed as a divine person and not simply as a prophet possessing extraordinary powers. But I don't care what Strauss said. Even Matthew, Mark, and Luke also very clearly make it clear that Jesus was God and certainly claimed to be God and did things that only God could do. Going back now to this, he believed that St. John had become familiar with Greek philosophy by the time he wrote his gospel, which I alluded to a while ago, which is manifested in his use of terms such as, and I'll quote from Strauss here, quote, divine sonship, the concept of the logos, and the idea of preexistence, end of quote. And following Strauss, a lot of modern scripture scholars and theologians believe that the church went down the wrong path when it adopted Greek philosophy to Christianity, especially the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle. But that's another topic, a very complex topic. And regarding Strauss's interpretation of this matter, Philip Trower writes, quote, that thinking provided St. John with a series of thought categories. This is according to Strauss now.
Okay.
He came to see all of these as ideal concepts for expressing his own and his fellow Christians' ever-deepening reverence for the person of Jesus. Now, he's talking about John and John's motive as he's writing his gospel. But he came to write his life of Jesus. These ideas were worked into the fabric of the narrative in such a way that later readers would see them as integral parts of the story of Jesus' life, rather than products of a long period of reflection which had resulted in the weaving together into a single account, both historical fact and John's introduction of mythical and philosophical elements into the narrating of the facts, end of quote. In other words, according to Strauss, it is mostly St. John's fault that early Christians came to believe that Jesus is God and that he performed miracles. Also, St. Paul comes in for a lot of criticism by modern scripture scholars for creating also the myth of the of Jesus' divinity.
Okay, so we would say that particularly in St. John's fourth gospel and in the writings of St. Paul, whom we're honoring all this year, that the divinity of Christ is very clearly explained and pointed to. There's no doubt if we would read some of Paul's epistles and the Gospel of John that they believed Jesus was truly God made man.
Yes, I know. But of course, obviously, you can see what their approach would be, that basically Paul is guilty of, Matthew, Mark, and Luke are guilty of myth-making.
Okay. All right. But it is true that if we want to help people know who the real Jesus is, read the Gospel of John. He's true God and true man. Read the words of Paul. He's true God and true man. Okay, what impact do you think Strauss's mythological approach had on biblical scholarship since his time? It must have been pretty profound.
I think it'll become evident that he had a big impact when we discuss later Catholic biblical scholars such as Renan and the Catholic modernists such as Fathers Loisy and Tyrell. I can best illustrate his impact on contemporary biblical scholars by quoting Borg, who's one of them. He's one of the contemporary biblical scholars, and certainly also an admirer of Strauss. He writes that, quote, though Strauss's book was called The Life of Jesus, it actually says relatively little about the historical Jesus. Instead, his main concern was the nature of the texts themselves, rather than the history of the figure behind the text. Some are classified as evangelical myths, others as historical myths, others as legends. The effect was to undermine the historicity of much of the gospel story. The details of Strauss's argument, his use of Hegelian philosophy, and even his definition of myth have not had a lasting impact yet. This is really important right here. Yet his basic claims that many of the gospel narratives are mythical in character, and that myth is not simply to be equated with falsehood, have become part of mainstream scholarship. What was widely controversial in Strauss's time has now become one of the standard tools of biblical scholars, end of quote. In other words, that basically one of the presuppositions that a biblical scholar has, many of them have, that this is all mythological, so that's the approach they take to the Gospels.
And Borg would say, who's supposed to be an authority on Strauss, that that was one of his lasting gifts to the scriptural movement.
Yes, Borg himself was a person who sort of underwent an experience somewhat similar to mine when he was a young man. And this is another article that he wrote that I got this information. He read these books, and basically he lost his faith. And it was a number of years that he began to gradually kind of regain his faith. But he never got back into an Orthodox faith. As a young boy, he'd been raised in an Orthodox Protestant family, if I recall right. Evangelical family, if I remember right. And I'm not sure which evangelical church or denomination. But Borg never really got back to Orthodoxy. He kind of gets into this mythological interpretations himself in his own work. And what he's trying to do, as you see later on, he begins to kind of apply some of the kind of ways that Schleiermacher and people like that approach to religion. It's a religion of the heart, that we can't trust the Gospels because the Gospels are just simply myths for the most part. So the only way that we can come to know anything about God's revelation is kind of a direct revelation, into the heart. And when we get into Catholic modernism, we're going to talk a lot about that particular view. I don't think Borg's view of revelation and this, that, and the other is a whole lot different than the one that, let's say, Catholic modernists have, that religion is something of the heart. Immanuel Kant kind of got people started on that whole thing.
We talked about him a long time ago.
Yes.
So, obviously, religion is of the heart, but it's not only of the heart.
It's also of the mind. You have to have the intellect as well.
Keep the both together.
Yes.
Ron, thank you for your wonderful presentation. Our time has run out, so to our listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.